Byzantine chant, a Greek Byzantine chant, introducing us here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod. And we want, where we discuss important events of the day for conservatives and others every Friday. And the Byzantine chant is appropriate today. We're going to be talking with Smir A. Zaidan on the Middle East, on Middle East faith and freedom. He's a counterterrorism analyst with the State Department, has worked with USAID in Iraq, and he comes from a Byzantine Rum Christian background from the Levant, and we want to talk about that along with his discussions of his experiences on issues of faith and freedom and minorities and the future development of the region. Well, welcome to the show, Smir A. Zaidan.
Thank you, Andrew. It is a pleasure to be with you.
Well, first of all, it's been very interesting looking over your writings at Jihad Watch, for example, where you are a contributor, and elsewhere at Providence, and you've written for the Los Angeles Times and Newsweek. First of all, describe your background. Where do you come from, and what ethnic background, religious background you have? What is your community in the Middle East?
Well, you know, I'm from the home. My hometown is Beit Jala, and we are, you know, the original residents of that area. I mean, we're Christians, Greek Orthodox Christians, and we've been living in that area since the time of Jesus Christ, because, you know, Christianity started basically from there. And some of us were more lucky than others, and we were able to continue living in that land despite, you know, the difficult times that went on that area. So I am considered, you know, the best way how to describe it is that even in search for an identity, it evolved within the years. So right now, a big part of us identify ourselves as Aramaic more than anything else, because you just cannot say Palestinian Christian, because there is no such thing, as a matter of fact, given the fact that in the concept of Palestinianhood, you cannot be Christian at the same time Palestinian, because you just cannot separate Islam from the identity of the Palestinians nowadays.
Yeah, those are important points. You know, it's interesting if you look at the Palestinian Basic Law for the Palestinian Authority. It has numerous sort of Islamic references in this Basic Law, which you can read online from the Palestinian Authority. It has, for example, Sharia, Islamic Sharia shall be the source or inspiration for legislation in the Palestinian Authority. It also has, like in the preamble, it has reference to Jerusalem, this Al-Quds city, as it's called in Arabic by Muslims, that this was the scene where Muhammad had his miraculous night journey, supposedly in the 7th century, when he was in Arabia in Medina, but then one night he was miraculously taken by a Pegasus to Jerusalem, and from there in the Temple Mount up into heaven to meet with God and receive instructions, for example, on things like how Muslims should pray. So that's referenced in the Palestinian Authority document, basic law. I believe also it says that, you know, Islam is the official religion of the Palestinian Authority. So it's important to note that this Palestinian Authority and this Palestinian society is actually not really secular. It's very Muslim. So for a Christian like you to try to live in that society, that, you know, that places a lot of serious questions of just how could any Christian community survive in this Palestinian, this Islamically defined Palestinian nation.
Well, we have to keep in mind, Andrew, that the Christians are right now a very small minority. They are just in Bethlehem area and in some villages near Ramallah. There is less than 1,000 Christian already in Gaza. The number keeps diminishing. Conditions get harder. But back to the issue of the impact of the so-called Palestinian Authority on the Christians, this is very, very important, because what keeps the Palestinians as Palestinians is the presence of this 1% of Christians. Remove those Christians and the Palestinian would be calling themselves the Islamic State of Palestine. You would immediately put the true image of what is the Palestinian issue all about, which is a religious one. As you just mentioned about Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, okay, in Arabic it is Al-Quds, regardless whether it's, I mean, in the Arabic language, we refer to it as Al-Quds or Bayt al-Maqdis, but Urushalim is also mentioned in Arabic. However, the main topic is the issue of the Temple Mount - Al-Aqsa Mosque. This is where Palestinians adamantly reject any and refuse to accept that, in fact, few thousand years ago, there was a temple here. And this was actually one of the main reasons that the peace process at Camp David came to a halt, because the late Palestinian president refused even to recognize such thing. And this was a major obstacle, which later on evolved to become an issue that the Israelis couldn't deal with him or couldn't treat him as a partner in the peace process. So definitely, it is not an easy thing to talk right now about the current situation without going into Sharia and into the religious topic, which is the most important element in this struggle. I mean, the Palestinians, you can see during the last 25 years, right after the Oslo Agreement, when everybody was kind, you know, many moderate Arabs believed that this is the peace, the Oslo Agreement wasn't good enough for the Palestinians. However, it was clear right from the beginning that Arafat wanted a foothold. He didn't care what the stipulation of the agreement. He didn't care. He wanted just to establish a foothold inside, and from there he would go to achieve his bigger goal. I'm not here to defend Israel under no circumstances whatsoever, but there was no plan whatsoever for the Palestinians to accept a real settlement. And this became evident later on in 2005, when the Israelis ended their presence in Gaza Strip. They had a unique opportunity to show to the world that they were able to move forward with their plan to establish a Palestinian state on the 1967 border. What happened after that? You saw how Gaza Strip became a proxy land for Iran. it became an area where they started improving their capacity of manufacturing missiles. And instead of helping the people of Gaza, Hamas usurped power in 2007. And after that, you could see nowadays how they brag how Gaza has improved its manufacturing skills of missiles. And so this leaves us with a big question. Why did the Palestinians lose the opportunity to show the world in 2005 that they were able to live up to their ambitions of having a Palestinian state on the 1967 border, calm the concerns of the Israelis who never trusted them? It was a matter of winning the Israeli trust. Had they been able to show that they could have established a peaceful area in Gaza, it would have injected more confidence in the Israeli population to move on with further mobilization in the West Bank. But obviously, that wasn't the case. And the West Bank is in the heart of Israel. If you look at the map closely, you can understand how strategically is important to the survival of the state of Israel.
Well, yeah, the Hamas, well, of course, Hamas then in relatively short order took over in the Gaza Strip after the 2005 Israeli withdrawal, this jihadist terrorist group, Muslim Brotherhood affiliate. That raises an interesting point that Brigadier General Yossi Kupferwasser, who was part of Israeli Defense Forces intelligence, he said at a conference in 2017 here in Washington, reported on for Jihad Watch, he said that, you know, the struggle against Zionism, against Israel, it's always been an Islamic Arabic struggle. It's always had an Islamic ideology. And Robert Spencer at Jihad Watch as well, of course, has written his book called The Palestinian Delusion, where he's documented in extensive detail that this motivating ideology against the establishment of Israel, Zionism, a Jewish state, has always been that territory should remain Islamic, and you should not have these infidel Jews, this hated Jewish people exercising sovereignty over once Muslim land, or for that matter, particularly over Jerusalem, with this proclaimed whole Islamic holy site where Muhammad went into heaven. You're raising important points here that this is. A lot of people here in the West, they want to understand this conflict as just some sort of self-determination conflict. If you simply pull out of the Gaza Strip, you know, then the Arabs there, they'll be so happy to be free of any occupation. They'll go just live their lives. But as we've seen, you know, they really have a jihadist ideology, and they'll just use that as a base to attack Israel. And as you know, with Arafat, of course, he infamously made a statement that the Oslo Accords, as he stated in a South African mosque, that this was just sort of this temporary truce, like the Hudaybiyah truce of Muhammad in the 7th century with his pagan enemies, that it wouldn't last long, and then we could go back to our struggle.
Indeed, indeed. That was mentioned several times. And as a matter of fact, there is no... let me tell you this. The religious aspect of the Palestinian issue is very strong, unlike what they tried to show. Like in the international arena, the Palestinians tried to show that it's a secular movement and that they have aspiration, and they use here and there some Christians to make it look like a national movement. They have some ministers who are Christians actually. But in fact, Islam is the major component, and that's why I doubt ever we were going to be able to see a permanent solution. I always, when I was working at the State Department, I always made reference about the need for M&M. And of course, I'm not referring to that. I'm referring to applying the rule of maintenance and management. That was the only thing we could offer in that part of the world. Because there was no way whatsoever we can bring a full settlement to that conflict, because there is nobody able to reach an agreement on the religious aspect of the conflict. You just cannot. How are you gonna, if you say this is, you know, the land of war and land of Islam, if you're gonna establish a Palestinian state, which is going to be eventually the land of Islam in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, then you're gonna look at Israel as the land of war. So this is gonna go on and on and on without an end. So basically, yes, the sad thing is that, as I was looking into the peace, the Oslo Peace Agreement in the 90s, when I was living there, to see how the Palestinians were fomenting a different kind of rhetoric among the new generations, and that they were going on full speed to Islamize the process. So slowly you could see how Bethlehem area was taken over by an influx of newcomers, the so-called returnees, those who came from Tunisia, and how they wanted to live in the Bethlehem area. And by some kind of financial support from some Islamic organizations, they started buying Christian properties. And then the whole theme over there was to Islamize, rather than to build a national state or to lay down a foundation for a future Palestinian state. If you read thoroughly what happened in Oslo, in Camp David, you will see right from the beginning that the Palestinians, and it's very sad to say this, they were playing the zero-sum game. Nothing would have appeased them. And even though when Arafat was gone, Ehud Olmert came after Sharon, and he was willing to come up with something that was really substantial. However, Mahmoud Abbas knew that he couldn't go ahead with it. And of course, then after that, you know that Olmert had to resign, and then he went to jail, to prison. But the issue here is that there is no one who has the courage to sign a permanent agreement. They just wanted to achieve a presence. And for them, for the Palestinian Authority right now, what they want to keep the status quo as is. They have no intention whatsoever to go any further, because they know that they're not going to be able to deliver eventually. They have lost the confidence even of the Palestinian people. So right now, the complexity of the situation goes way beyond an Israeli-Palestinian conflict as much as to look at it internally within the Palestinians themselves. And Andrew, let me give you an example of how you can gauge the impact of Islam on the Palestinians. I don't know whether you remember what happened last July, but last July, we all saw when Erdogan decided to turn the Hagia Sophia Cathedral into a mosque. You wouldn't believe that the Palestinian flag was there in the yard of the cathedral. They were celebrating along with their Turkish brothers this huge achievement. There was this euphoria among the Palestinians that they really got back the Hagia Sophia mosque. And then there was this popular campaign by the Palestinians on the social media to falsely claim that the Sultan, the Ottoman Sultan, bought, in fact, the cathedral from the Greek Orthodox Patriarch, and that this was purchased. It was a legal business that was conducted then. They just paid them the money and bought the church, as some churches do here in the United States. So this euphoria shows clearly that the religious fanaticism has reached an alarming level. And this is overwhelming. I'm not talking about Gaza. Of course, Hamas congratulated officially Erdogan for such a historic decision. And there was rumors also that the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, talked with Erdogan, and he did mention this, that he congratulated Erdogan for changing the cathedral into a mosque. With this incident, it shows the affiliation and what really pulls Islam and nothing but Islam.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. Itamar Marcus, for example, at Palestinian Media Watch, at a conference in Jerusalem I attended a couple of years ago, he made the point, he gave a presentation and he presented survey data from the Palestinian society, noted that it's really, according to such survey data, it's a very devout society, devoutly Muslim society. You know, we often perhaps talk in the United States about, like, say, Saudi Arabia being this really devout society and being the source of all of this extremism. But, you know, maybe you could make an argument that modern Palestinian society today is more devout than, say, Saudi Arabia or other Gulf states that are becoming more integrated with the wider world. They have more exposure to the West and to travel and economic links and so forth. Well, describe your experience. You know, you mentioned you come from Beit Jalal, which is a town near Bethlehem, a historically Christian town, just like Bethlehem was, used to be a majority Christian town until, as you indicate, after the Oslo Accords, all these the Palestinian Authority promoted all of this movement of Muslims into Bethlehem. And Beit Jalal, for example, as I learned on one of these conference trips to Israel, was where Fatah terrorists, they would go into this Christian town and they would shoot up across at the nearby Israeli town of Gilo and would open fire on. And that was before the security barrier was built. And they, as I was told, they would shoot precisely from Beit Jalal because they wanted to try to get the Israelis to fire back into this Christian town with these Christian churches and Christian cemeteries to try to create an international incident. What has life been like for you as a Christian in such a community like Beit Jalal, growing up and living in this wider Muslim majority society?
First, Beit Jalal is the only 100% Christian town historically. Didn't have not even one Muslim living in Beit Jalal. Beit Jalal was always a Christian town. It is believed that St. Nicholas in the 4th century lived in Beit Jalal when he visited the Holy Land. Came from Minor Asia, he stayed there. So till today, there is the Church of St. Nicholas. And funny that it also has the Catholic seminar where, you know, priests study. The seminary over there is very known to be the place where most of the Catholic priests receive their education in the Middle East. They come to Beit Jalal. So what happened with once the Palestinian Authority arrived, you could see that those who were already living in Beit Jalal wanted to enhance the Islamic presence. So I strongly believe that there were a lot of financial support to Muslim entities to purchase Christian properties. That was the first thing during the 90s. Then they were trying hard to take control over many of the social centers in Beit Jalal, which were run by the church, but they couldn't because for X, Y, the reason we managed to keep all these organizations under Christian control. When the Intifada broke up in September 2000, at the end of September 2000, after Sharon's visit to the mosque, which was used as the main catalyst behind launching the military campaign against Israel. In a few months, we saw Bejala becoming as a fire base where Fatah militants would come out from outside Bejala and they go inside the cemetery, which is very front of Gilo. They would shoot at Gilo. They would stand behind the churches hoping for the Israelis to retaliate against the church in order to say, oh, look, the Israelis are shooting at the churches. Of course, in a couple of occasions, windows got broken. We don't know who shot at them, but obviously it was crystal clear that the Palestinian militants were trying to provoke the Israelis at all levels to shoot back and to put the blame on them for hurting Christians. So at the beginning, there was a German doctor who was married to a Christian woman in Bejala. And during one of these attacks, he got killed. And of course, he got killed because he walked out of his house and he started moving around. Of course, he was killed. Nobody could tell at night whether he was a militant or a civilian. So he got killed by an Israeli projectile. So next day at the funeral, I was stunned to see that the Palestinians put the German flag on the coffin of this doctor. And I was just like, excuse me, why you put the German flag? And they said, you know, Israel killed a German citizen. And I said, excuse me, but you know, Israel didn't know that first he was a German, and second, Israel didn't even know that he was a civilian. Gave me the feeling like, oh, we're going towards a further escalation where they're going to be trying to take advantage of us as Christians. And this proved to be right. We have some Christians who got killed. I know of a case where the Palestinian so-called Navy provoked a shooting at a Christian car where a woman got killed. The driver, Christian, he's from Bejala, he told me that. I said, what happened? He said, as we were approaching the Palestinian checkpoint inside Bejala, the Palestinian soldiers started shooting at the Israeli side, which is like a mile away, which caused a retaliation, and this woman got killed. So the man was telling me straightforward that he put the blame on the Palestinians. And of course the woman got killed and they made out of her a Palestinian martyr. But I knew deep in my heart that this woman was sacrificed by the Palestinian militants to say, look, Israel is killing Christians. And for me, when I saw the kids of the woman, because she left kids behind, orphans, this was a major cause of stress for me. But the main element, the main incident that really made me completely lose any connection with the so-called Palestinian Authority was when two Christian girls, two teenagers, were raped, tortured, and killed by Fatah militants. And Fatah militants terrorized the entire town. So I happened to be there, and I went to the funeral, which was attended by 13 people. I saw inside the Greek Orthodox Church two coffins of two girls dressed in white like brides. And there were only 13 people, 13 persons inside the church. One American journalist with me, we walked inside the church. And honestly, that was the time when I lost my objectivity, my role as a stringer, as a journalist, or whatever you want to call. The scene itself impacted me. And since then, every time I go to sleep, I remember these two girls. And I remember the scene. And it's an open wound that never healed. Now, what happened later on is amazing, is that the Palestinian Authority even destroyed the medical report. They made a cover-up to exonerate the militants. And when I was asking about the incident, they said, oh, the medical reports got lost because of the Israeli incursions. Excuse me? Are you telling me that the Israelis were coming into Beit Jala to look for the medical reports? So it showed clearly that there was a deliberate attempt to cover up for this. And from that day on, I said, no, those people you cannot trust because they're willing to sacrifice you in order to achieve their political goals. Besides, they're willing to take advantage of Christians and abuse them. And the killing of these two girls is a good example. Another night, they were shooting from the cemetery, from the Greek Orthodox cemetery. Next day in the morning, the person who works at the cemetery walks into the cemetery, and guess what? All the crosses smashed. The church is desecrated in a scary manner. Of course, that couldn't be by shootings. It was done by hands, by someone who was inside the cemetery. And who was during that night in the cemetery? It was the Fatah militants. So again, this was like, come on, guys, wake up. I mean, what are we getting out of this? We, the so-called Christian Palestinians, what are we getting out of this? Are we going to keep talking with this schizophrenia? Or are we developing the Stockholm syndrome here, that we're being kidnapped by the Palestinian militants, and yet when we are officially asked, we defend them? How could that be possible, for God's sake? So for me, that was an internal struggle for me, but I needed to keep my objectivity. But what happened eventually is that I managed to work with the U.S. government in Iraq, and since then I got totally disconnected from living the day-to-day suffering of the Christian every now and then, and I keep now a closer look of what is happening. The situation has deteriorated to an alarming level, and now the Christians in Bethlehem have one hope to keep them alive and to keep them living in that area. That is, they reach out to Israel. This sounds like what? Yes, the Christians living in the Bethlehem area have no hope whatsoever. I got a text message yesterday from someone who's conducting a study. He said, in 7 years, you might not see Christians left in Bethlehem, and maximum in 20 years in Beit Jala, the churches will be totally abandoned. And I asked him, do you have any suggestion what should be done in order to preserve the Christian presence in that area? And he said, Chris, unless we are part of Israel, there is no way we can survive unless we become Israelis. And this is where it becomes very intriguing, is that we need what I call the broken alliance remedied. The Christian presence in that area is only possible with an Israeli protection. And again, now sadly, of course, the Israelis deal with this issue with apathy and pity. I mean, they try their best to help the Christian Palestinians, you know, with certain privileges here and there, but it's not enough. This is not enough. What they need is that they need to be liberated from living under the thumb of the Palestinian Authority, which is inept, corrupt, and unable to apply the rule of law. Because after area is becoming so corrupt, so lawless, and lawlessness is prevailing to an alarming level. And this explains why we had the incident where this refugee dweller attacks a renowned Christian doctor, and he almost killed him. And this was the second attack against him in 1 year because the Palestinian Authority is not willing to stand up and protect the Christians. Not because they don't want to protect Christians, because it is a corrupt entity. That is what is happening. And right now, and the sad thing is that Israel doesn't care about this as long as there is security coordination with the Palestinian side. As long as Israel counts on Israel, on Palestinian coordination and security and giving them information to prevent terrorists from attacking Israel, Israel turns a blind eye. And that's why I say no. Israel has a moral obligation to protect those Christians who, as you just said, cross the street in certain areas between Gilo and Beit Jala. And by the way, the separation wall did not protect Israel from shooting. It protected Israel from suicide bombers who were walking inside Israel, who were to carry out attacks inside Israel. But the shooting danger is still there. And in fact, 2 days ago, there was heavy shooting inside one of the refugee camps in Bethlehem in protest for, because they kept the attacker in prison and he hasn't been released so far. So this shows clearly that the situation is chaotic and has reached an alarming level.
Yeah, but at Gilo, for example, I remember they were telling us on the tour there of the security barrier that, you know, the people living in Gilo, they had to put in bulletproof windows into their apartments, you know, for their kitchens and their living rooms and so forth. Otherwise, you know, you could be watching TV and have a bullet come flying into your living room. And indeed, that's precisely why sometimes often around the world, we see these pictures of this massive concrete barrier, this wall, as it's called, as if that's the entire security barrier. But such large walls actually exist in certain parts of the Israeli security barrier, precisely because they have to be so high in order to prevent shooting. That's the only way to block the line of sight, to block any fire in certain areas from the Palestinian territories into Israel. And that's why you have that such a massive wall in some places, although in most areas of the security barriers, it's just sort of a fence and patrol roads and such. But from your own experience, it raises a lot of interesting questions of Christians. In the past, Arab Christian communities, they've tried to develop Arab nationalism. I mean, we can think of Michel Aflaq, the developer, the leader of the Ba'ath Party, the theorist behind that. He came from a Christian background, and that Christian Arabs, they promoted Arab nationalism with this idea that we'll all try to be Arabs together. So we'll try to minimize whatever religious differences there are between Muslims and Christians, and we'll try to emphasize that we're all one united Arab community. But does your own experience show that our Christians among the Palestinian Arabs and in the wider Middle East, are they turning away from such ideas of Arab nationalism? Has that just proven to be a complete failure? And now more and more Christian people from, like you, from a Christian background, are really seeing to ally themselves with Israel or with other non-Muslim Arab powers, with the West, say? Is that a common experience? What's the development of Christian Arab attitudes towards the Middle East and their Muslim neighbors?
Well, you have to look at it in the last 100 years. It's more than 100 years of process. Remember that the region was part of the Ottoman Empire, which heavily applied the rule of dhimmitude. You know, the Christians were dhimmis, the Jews were dhimmis, and they had to pay special taxes and what have you. Now, with the fall of the Ottoman Empire, there was a new surge of new identity, which started from the so-called Arab Revolt. Now, Christians living in that area, of course, they felt that that was a big relief to start establishing a national identity while they just got rid of the Ottoman Caliphate. They were living under Islamic Caliphate under the rule of the Ottoman Empire. The Sultan was the Caliph of Muslims. So now the Christian so-called Arabs started to really like Michel Afflack, Constantine Drake, and others, and Anton Saadi in Lebanon, they all started coming up with this national movement, with these national movements to create nations, to build up nations based on human beings coming together, sharing maybe a different religious background, but hey, at the end of the day, we're making a nations. Now, it succeeded in a little bit in forming a new identity, but it only failed because Islam once again emerged as the main character or the main power behind these movements. So that's why you see even Ba'ath as an ideology created by Michel Afflack failed. And you can see that in Iraq. Iraq was at the time of in the 70s, it was, well, you can say secular to a certain extent. But maybe you don't know that Michel Afflack eventually converted to Islam. And he wrote a book called The Memory of the Arab Prophet. He made out of him idol, the example to follow. And that was something not many people know about, that Michel Afflack was buried as a Muslim, and his name was converted to Ahmed Michel Afflack. And he had to do that, despite the fact that he was not only secular, but atheist as well, because he knew that he couldn't reach out to the Arabs as a non-Muslim. So that's number one. That shows that from the beginning, this was destined to a failure. Now, this led to the new search for identity, which emerged basically in Lebanon. The Christians in Lebanon have suffered immensely because of the Ottoman Empire. And they made sure to create their own identity within an entity which is called the Jabal Lubnan. They didn't want to be part of bigger Syria because they knew that even in the 19th century there were many massacres committed against Christians in Aleppo and so on and so forth. So right now, the Palestinians, if you want to talk about Palestinian Christians, they are evolving into what I just told you, the Aramaic background, that we look at ourselves, that we are Aramaic, and we can live within a secular... This is funny. A Jewish state that is democratic, it can guarantee you freedom, and it can guarantee you full citizenship. And I can prove to you with statistics. Christians, between brackets, Arabs inside Israel, have achieved a higher academic level than Jews. Why is that? It was only possible because of the presence of, gave them the opportunity to live and to excel. That's not possible in under Islam. So we have a movement already of inside Israel of Christian Arabs who now say, we are not Arabs, we are Aramaic, and we can be full citizens of Israel, and we can and once we serve in the IDF, we are able to reclaim our rights, full rights, including being represented in the Knesset, and so on and so forth. So the same thing right now is happening among Christian Palestinians. They are 100% aware that they have no future, and the main thing they have in mind is that they want to leave the country and immigrate. They cannot keep living there. But a lot of them, not a lot of them, the vast majority supports the idea of being integrated as part of the state of Israel. And of course, the failure of the Arab identity is overwhelming. There is no such thing as an Arab identity. Right now, we are talking about the Palestinian identity, which I told you right at the beginning, that you cannot separate an identity, which definitely for me as a Christian, I cannot associate myself with such identity. Why should I? Why should I consider myself Palestinian if the so-called Palestinian identity is composed of an integral part of Islamic Sharia law? It's not like they're forming an Islamic state which is democratic. No, 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 no. There is no such thing as democracy and Islam. They say it openly. They tell you, we do not believe in democracy. You will have to live under the tolerance. That's what they say. You live here among us because of the tolerance of Islam. Because Islam, quote unquote, is a religion of peace. And because of that, we allow you to live here in peace. But this is because we are tolerant to accept you, kind of class citizen, as someone who is inferior to us being a non-Muslim. So are you willing to accept that, Andrew? This is the question. For someone who has lived most of his life abroad, I lived most of my life abroad, studied abroad in the United States, and I came to cherish freedom. And also I lived most of my years under the Israeli administration. I used to question Israeli soldiers when the West Bank was under the control of the full Israeli military presence. On one occasion, I had an argument with an Israeli soldier because he didn't want me to go into Rachel's tomb in Bethlehem. And I remember he used the word Asur. I remember I was 18 years old, and I said, what is Asur? And a guy texted me and said, it's forbidden or prohibited. I said, no, I have the right to walk in. Rachel, according to my faith, is one of our mothers. Because Abraham is our spiritual father, according to Christian faith, even if we were not Jews who converted to Christianity. But Abraham, for us, from a religious point of view, we are. So I was arguing with this Israeli soldier, and he was kind of like shocked. He didn't know how to answer me back. With this argument, you cannot go to the Al-Aqsa mosque and say, excuse me, here, once there was a church, and here, 40 days after the birth of Jesus Christ, he was brought here to where once there was a temple, and where the Simon the Elder carried the Lord, and he thanked the Lord for keeping him alive to see the Lord. So if I go right now and I tell the Muslims, the Temple Mount, hey, guys, there is a Temple Mount here. The least they can do is kick me out of there, if not something else. This shows clearly why right now there is no hope, there is no future for the Christian Palestinians. And I say that objectively, and I'm totally convinced of the consequences of what I'm saying, that the Palestinian Christians will not survive. And in a decade or so, we're going to be referring to them as in the past tense, unless some dramatic steps taken quickly to ensure that they are given the possibility of becoming Israeli citizens. That is the only way how they can survive.
Yeah, that raises interesting points. It's been noted that the mayor of Bethlehem back in 1994, right after the signing of the Oslo Accords, when Israel then began its process of withdrawal from Bethlehem and to hand over that territory to the Palestinian Authority, he actually urged that the Israelis take Bethlehem and the wider region, its surrounding neighborhood, Beit Jalal and so forth, and make it part of the District of Jerusalem. And Bethlehem had actually been once in the past part of Jerusalem and governed by Jerusalem. So he wanted, you know, Bethlehem and Beit Jalal to actually become part of Israel. He was really fearing, you know, this Muslim-dominated Palestinian Authority from exercising control. Could that actually happen in the future? Could Israel maybe, under any sort of future peace plan or development, annex Beit Jalal or even Bethlehem and have that become part of Israel?
Well, the issue of reformation, that was a say here, say that, but actually like a week ago, I was given the true story behind what happened right before Israel pulled out of Bethlehem area. It was actually in 1994. The Israeli highest authority in Judea Samaria held a meeting with the three mayors of Bethlehem area, the mayor of Beit Jala, the mayor of Bethlehem, and the mayor of Beit Sahur. And he told them, we have to move on and leave. What is it that you want? The mayor of Beit Jala, the late mayor of Beit Jala, was explicit and said that he was in favor of keeping the Israelis and that eventually it should be annexed to Israel. Now, and sadly, that the mayor of Bethlehem, who was once threatened by Arafat himself a few years earlier to shoot him because he only talked about truce during the first Intifada, said that he would abstain. He was not going to vote neither in favor nor against. And sadly, the mayor of Beit Sahur followed suit of the mayor of Bethlehem, and that's why we didn't have consensus. And the Israelis couldn't protect the Christian Palestinians if their leaders were not willing to stand up for themselves. And that is the sad issue here. Is that I'm not here trying to justify that Israel did not protect the Palestinians, but could you protect the Christian Palestinians if they are unable to stand up for their rights? If they are so terrorized that in the official language, when they are put in front of the camera, they talk about their Muslim brothers and they talk about the aspiration of the Palestinianhood and they talk about how they are part of this big nation, blah, 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 blah. While in secret, they talk about their agony and their sufferings with their so-called Muslim brethren. So there is a limit how much Israel can offer. Again, it has to be that the Palestinian Christians who have to stand up for their rights and to really speak in one voice in favor of that. Of course, in that time it was easier. Right now it's more difficult, but there are still ways how to get your message across. And they are afraid. You cannot place, they cannot, the Christian Palestinians cannot smart here by sitting in their house expecting the Israelis to come and knock on their door and say, hey, would you like to become an Israeli citizen? Oh, yeah, why not? No, no, it doesn't work this way. Second, you have to understand that the majority of the population in Bethlehem area right now are Muslims. Now, to what extent Israel wants to add them, but there is a different story here. Israel can add the Christians and making them as Israeli citizens. By doing so, even if the area is not annexed officially to Israel, this would enable them for full protection from the state of Israel, because the Palestinian Authority has no authority, no power over Christian citizens who live inside the Palestinian areas. So there is a step one here. Step number one is that you need to start enlisting those people and making them Israeli citizens. And we're not talking about a change, or we're making it eventually. There will be no eventual, because Israel is not going to pull out of the West Bank. It's not going to allow a Palestinian state established between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean. And if they allowed that, that would be suicidal, in my opinion. So right now we need steps that need to be taken now. We cannot wait like when they sit and start talking and let's see in 5 years and then that this is going to be part of a bigger agreement, because the Palestinian Authority will not want to see the Christians leave, because remember, when they leave, they're going to take with them the Church of Nativity. We, the Christians in Bethlehem area, once we leave and we become Israeli citizens, we're not moving into Israel and leaving Bethlehem for them. We want to keep Bethlehem united with Jerusalem. And the Palestinians will not accept that. And I can tell you something. They will fight against the Palestinian Christians who would really speak up their mind in favor of that project, in a very violent way. And I wouldn't be surprised to see people getting killed and assassinated among the Christians. So this is not an easy thing, actually, to do. It needs a full Israeli involvement. If Israel has the desire right now to really help the Christian Palestinians, they can do that. And they can do it, as I just told you. They give them citizenship without changing the status of the area.
Well, I guess
because
in closing out...
Because that would way different. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I guess in closing out here, thinking of the wider Middle East, you've also written about your experience in Iraq working for USAID during the coalition efforts after overthrowing Saddam Hussein, as well as recent developments in Egypt with various atheist intellectuals, bloggers, and Muslim reformers in Egypt, and the sort of the conflicts they faced in Egypt. What do you think the prospects are for reforming the region, making it more liberal, moving it towards democracy, based on your efforts in engaging online with counter-extremism efforts, countering jihadist ideology and so forth? What sort of policies, what sort of messages will work in trying to bring any sort of reform to this region in Egypt or Iraq or in the wider Muslim world?
Well, very quickly, because we are getting Iraq, I witnessed the dramatic change among the Iraqis in 2003, from April to December in that year. In 8 months, I saw the huge rupture, the division between Sunni and Shiite. In April, they were still talking, referring to themselves as Iraqis. In December, I could see the Iraqis referring to themselves as Sunnis and the others as Shiites. So this is not something that can be remedied. Now, it will take right now Iraq, and because of the dramatic mistake of going into Iraq, we really gave Iraq as a gift to Iran. So let's make it clear there that right now Iraq is just a proxy to Iran and to the Shiite sect. In Egypt, the story is a bit different, because right now we have a strong president who is trying his best to really control Islamic radicalism. Whether he's going to be able to do that or not, God only knows. But always Muslim Brotherhood, right now, they ended their hibernation because we have a new administration here in the United States, which tends to sleep in bed with them every now and then. And that is the danger right now, is that Muslim Brotherhood in the region feel that they have the shot right now to revolt one more time against the secular movements and what have you in that part of the world.
Well, I guess quickly, in your experience with counterterrorism, what is sort of the most effective message you can give in trying to counter any jihadist ideology?
I do not believe in any soft message. When you are dealing with jihadists, you have to tell them, we're going after you. And you have to tell them, look what happened to Osama bin Laden. Look what happened to Baghdadi. This is going to happen to you. If you try to hurt us, we're not going to sit and watch. But trying to look into common ground to communicate with them, that makes no sense. They will perceive it as weakness, and they will strike. And this can prove my point that during the previous administration, from 2009 till 2016, a lot of terrorist attacks inside the United States. From 2017 to 2020, I could only recall one incident that happened by Saudi soldiers who were training in Florida. So you have to understand, once you tell them straightforward that you're not going to tolerate anything, they behave very well. And you could see that Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, they all are normalizing with Israel. Because of the effort, when we showed them that we were not going to be tolerant, when it comes to subsidizing or supporting Islamic movements. We have to keep on. If you want to carry out an effective campaign, counter-terrorist campaign, counter-jihadi campaign, you have to remain firm that there is zero tolerance, and we will not accept anything more than that.
All right. Well, to our listeners, you've been listening to Samir A. Zadon here for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod, as we've discussed issues of faith and freedom in the Middle East. I hope you'll join in next week, next Friday, for another episode. And for Samir A. Zadon, thank you for joining us here on the show.
Thank you, sir. It's been a pleasure.
Excellent.